First of all, I'd like to say that I've been nervous the whole time writing for this and thinking what I was going to say, and I had prepared some things and nothing was coming together. And then just by Srila Prabhupada's mercy, just a few moments before coming in here, I got some clarity of perspective on what I wanted to say. And first of all, I wanted to express that what I want to speak about is more realizations than actually tattva in an authoritative sense, because for the last quite a long time I've been living in the West, and I haven't been in touch with the subject matter to the depths or the degree that I would have liked to, or that I was when I was living in Vrindavan. So you'll have to forgive me for that. So I was thinking, as we were hearing the various subject matter about the Holy Name and then the Srimad Bhagavatam, that it's actually a fact, as we all know, that the chanting of the Holy Names is the essence of all sadhana, it's the essence of all advice, it's the essence of the process. And yet, we recognize that there are different types of people in this world and they have different kinds of natures. And therefore we see that five main aspects of the Swarup Shakti, or of devotional potent devotional service, have been defined. We also see that, as we were hearing in the Bhagavatam, that Bhishma Dev, because of his particular nature, he was offering arrows instead of offering roses. So that doesn't mean that everybody who offers arrows, their arrows are going to be accepted, because the process of devotional service recommends that one should offer beautiful flowers. But it does mean that there is room for all sorts of different types of people within the process of devotional service, and it is the fortune of the devotee as they find out where and how Krishna is inspiring them. So I also remember reading the Srila Prabhupada was explaining in the nine processes of devotional service, you can practice one of them, you can practice all of them, but even a slight performance of any one of them, and the same with the five angas of bhakti, even a slight performance is enough to develop one spiritually. One time I remember meeting one Indian gentleman in Vrindavan, and we were discussing various things, and he was looking at me. He asked me various questions, observing my manner, demeanor, conduct, and so forth. And he said to me after some time, he looked at me, he said, "You've done no sadhana." And I said, "How does he know?" And he said, "And you've done no bhajan." He said, "But just by wandering in the places of Braj, you've made advancement." So this is the amazing thing about Vrindavan, that even if one is not highly qualified, just by wandering in the places of Braj, one can make advancement. So I'd like to just speak a little about my own circumstance to begin with, and then we can speak something about the Dharms. So I came to live in Vrindavan with my husband in 1983, and we lived here in Vrindavan for about 13 years. And at that time I saw the Dham, and I saw basically everyone through the eyes of a Braj resident devotee. And I never really forgot that I was a guest, because the FRO don't let you forget. They constantly give you the sense that you're a foreigner. In India, we noticed, was it in Hong Kong, we were noticing that the sign at the airport, they have residents and visitors. And then we come to India and it says residents and foreigners. So they never allow you to forget, by Srimati Radharani's mercy, that you're not naturally from this place. And so I found myself always aware that at some point I might have to leave. And this became so acute at one stage that I started thinking, what would I do if I had to leave? What would I take with me? How would I remember Vrindavan? So as perhaps many of you know, then I started collecting pieces of twigs and leaves and water and dust and so on. And as the BIHE became popular, my husband started asking me to make little boxes with these items that I had for the speakers. And so then that started to become quite an absorption for me, and I started going around Vrindavan, and I would look at everything through the eyes of what I could put in the little box. And so I'd go to all the different places after I did the first Rajmandal Prakram, somewhat unsuccessfully, I was unable to complete it. I took the opportunity to go back by vehicle, which at that time people weren't doing, and go to all the places and collect water and bottles and dust in bags. And anyone who saw the room that I used to make the boxes in, it was looked like a chemist's shop or something. There were bottles and bottles and bottles. I think I had at least about 70 bottles of different kund water. And so when I was leaving Vrindavan, it was very difficult because I had all these old Bisleri bottles all gathering dust and all this water, and I didn't know what to do with it, so I put all the water into a bucket, and then I took a bath with that water and then poured some of it outside. But it was difficult, and it was funny because all it was bags and bags of dust and bottles of water. But it was very significant to me because it helped me to remember the specific places. So then leaving Vrindavan, we've been living now for 7 years in the West. As anyone also knows who travels, it's not very easy to get dust and water across the boundaries of many countries. And Australia is no exception. They give you quite a difficult time if you try to take anything natural from Vrindavan, if they catch you. So then I found myself in Perth, and we've been there for 7 years. And still I had the impression of these places in many photographs. So slowly by slowly blew the pictures up and put them on the walls. And in this way I found it gave some solace that you could remember the places. So all around my room, plastered on all the walls, were pictures. Pictures of Puri, pictures of Vrindavan, and pictures of different Vaishnava acharyas. Then in 1997, I've made a little book actually, which I thought some of the devotees might like to look at afterwards. A friend of mine sent a present, and it was a little deity. You can see. And. Now it is. Then it was only one deity. It was just a little small Krishna deity. This deity had a history. The deity had been found in 1996 in San Francisco by Upendra, who was at that time with Srila Prabhupada. I don't know if Srila Prabhupada had any exchange with him over the deity, but Upendra kept this deity very meticulously. And Upendra was an interesting person because much of the time he was serving Srila Prabhupada as his personal servant, but he also had his own personal weaknesses. So he tended to go from one extreme to the other, either intimate service or great difficulty in the material world, and back to intimate service, back to great difficulty, whereas most of us just plod along in the middle course. He had both experiences. So after Srila Prabhupada's departure from this world, Upendra gradually degenerated in many ways in his devotional service and his life. But he had one amongst many because of the exalted side of his nature and all the service he had rendered. He retained one characteristic, and that was that he always carried his bead bag. He didn't chant, I don't think, very much, and he didn't go to the most wholesome of places. In fact, he went to all kinds of places that devotees would never go. But in all of those circumstances, he always carried his bead bag. And inside his bead bag, he had a little tiny bag. And inside that little bag, he had this deity. So he carried this deity with him from 1996 and 1966, right up until his death, which was in 1997. So then the deity was somehow or other came to me. So then I started making things, and because my nature is more towards the artistic than towards the study and the chanting and so on, for better and worse. So I started making little things, little thrones, and then little asanas, and then little houses, and then trees. And it started to become like a meditation, actually, to make some kind of an environment for the deity. And gradually it wasn't satisfying just to make something decorative. You can decorate and you feel satisfied at first, but then there's further that I started wanting to go, which was to go into the pastimes and to the places. And I had a sort of a sense that it would be very nice to have some type of a gallery, a museum, perhaps, whatever you could say, that would be related to the holy dharms and also to, from the point of the deity going into the pastimes in an artistic mode. So slowly by slowly, as I've outlined in the picture book, different things came about. And eventually, at the point that at this particular stage, when I left Perth, we have now got a small caravan, and we have many dioramas that came from, all originating from the one deity. In 1998, I brought him to Vrindavan to find a Radharani for him. It was sort of like having an unmarried son to work out what you were going to do here. And so I went all over Delhi looking for a similarly sized Radharani deity. And naturally enough, I knew I wasn't going to find one. And so then I came back to Vrindavan and spoke with an old friend there who has a silver shop. And I begged him, I said, "You've got to make me this small, small Radharani deity." And he said, "Oh, Mataji, it's too hard. It's so small. These deities are old. They come from South India. It's a different style. It's not possible. I can't do it." So I kept begging him and begging him. And out of affection, he explained to me, first we have to carve one out of stone. Then we have to make a mold of the stone one. Then we have to pour the silver gold inside. Then we have to file it down with the finest of files. And then the deity is ready. And all of these processes aren't available here. And so I said, "Delhi." And he said, "If you wanted to make 1,000 or 2,000, they would make you a special kind of a quality mold. And then you could make so many." I said, no, I only want one. So then he thought about it and thought about it, and secretly behind my back, actually, he went out and he tried to find somebody to carve a small deity. So one day when I went down to talk to him, he was very proud of himself. He showed me this little deity, but it wasn't quite right, and it was really awkward because he didn't know quite what to say, but her head was rather large compared to her size. So I said, "Oh, that's nice." I said, "Is it possible that he could sort of carve the head a little more finer?" And he sort of said, "Well, I can ask him." So then I had to go away for some time. And whilst I was away, I contacted him. And he told me he made another one. So this other one's better. So I said, "All right, well, don't do anything till I come back." But out of his enthusiasm, he went ahead and he made a one of each of those two deities. And it's very intricate because they have to take the stone one and place it in sand. They make the mold out of sand. Not even like plaster, which gives you a great refinement of detail. And then they make the original. So when I came back, he took out, very proudly, two deities. And neither of them were quite what I had in mind, but there were two, and there they were. And he said to me, "I can't do any more. I can't file them down. I can't do any of the rest. You'll have to do it." He said, "I'll stop here." So I had to take these two little deities and go around to the Murtiwalas and beg them in various ways, "Please, can you just, you know, file down a little bit?" And I got one man who did a little work on them, but they remained somewhat unformed, and they were equal size to Gopinath. So then I thought, now I've got two. And then I realized that actually Gopinath in Vrindavan is with two. On one side is Srimati Radharani, not on the side we see here, but on the other side is Srimati Radharani, on the side that Vishakha Devi is in our mandir, and on the side where Srimati Radharani is next to Shyamasunda is not Srimati Radharani, but it's Ananga Manjari, or Janava Devi, whose manifest pastimes were completed in the Gopinath mandir. So there is a story, of course, there's a significance behind that, which I don't want to go into in great detail now. But nevertheless, somehow or other, Gopinath came and he stayed and started expanding and expanding and expanding. And now I found a way to get little stone deities carved independently of that man. And I think at this time I have about 200 small little like-sized deities that go in the Braj Leela, and then small Chaitanya Leela deities, the smallest still actually carved in Jagannath Puri, of Navadvip Lila, Jagannath Puri Lila, so I have the different levels of dharms in a, on an altar. So, for me, I could say, and you could probably understand by that, that the dharm is the most essential inspiration for me in my devotional service. So then I was thinking to myself what I was supposed to say here, and it kept coming in my mind that there were three levels on which, when I used to take people on parikrama, I used to talk to them about the dharm, and also on which my memories rested whilst I was back in the West. And now when I would come to Vrindavan, I came in a different way. I come as a guest or a foreigner, a real foreigner, and I'd come looking like I did when I had the boxes for what I could take back in the way of impressions that would help to sustain me when I was in the West. So while I was reflecting on this, I reflected that there were three levels on which one can appreciate the Dharma, either depending on one's level of realization or depending on the day that you go out. Sometimes you go out and you feel very flat. Sometimes you go out and you have a wonderful parikram. But there's always one level on which you can enter. So the first and most superficial, you could say, or the most immediate level is the cultural level. That by coming to the Dharma and observing, just observing the people, just looking at the animals, just feeling the atmosphere in the villages, by keeping your eyes open and looking at things. Because when I lived here for so many years, I used to go out and I couldn't understand the language, neither did I have much hope of learning it, so I would just look at everything. And by looking, it's as if you take photos with your mind, photos with your heart, and they go very deeply. When you go back to the West, you start looking at things, especially for one who has been living here for a long time, and you just, I found myself quite horrified. I think this naturally happens even with people who've been here for a certain amount of time and become saturated. When you walk back into the brazen Western cultural setting, it's sort of shocking to you, although no one who's living there is at all shocked. They're all taking everything quite naturally. But if you can absorb something of the culture of Vrindavan, see how the ladies behave, see how the children act, look at the animals, look at how they dress, ask questions about these things, you can see a different culture which tends to be able to inhibit to a great degree your affiliation with the Western culture, which is a level that I've seen living in the West. It's very difficult to do that unless you come to India. Most devotees think, I'm an Australian devotee, I'm a New Zealand devotee, and they're very much caught up in the local difficulties, the local problems, even their family or the area around them, and they can't lift themselves up from that setting and think of themselves in a far more broader way. So the Dharma on the most external level is very valuable for this. Then the second level on which I found that the Dharma is very wonderful is on the level of sadhana, that we all saw when we were chanting our 64 rounds, how uplifting it was just to sit beside Govardhan. And even if we didn't know anything about Govardhan, we didn't know the leelas, we didn't know anything, we just newly come here, still there's such a buoyant transcendental atmosphere in the Dharma that it's a little like if you take a child and you put a float around them and you ask them to jump into the water and they can't swim. But when they jump into the water, they find, I can swim. And they start splashing around. And I had personal experience of this with my son when I took him from Vrindavan to teach him to swim in Australia. And the instructor, and this was also instructive to me, the instructor, he was about 7 years old, she gave him a float to teach him in the water. But the difficulty was that when he got in the water with his float on, he became so self-confident that now I can swim. So what need is there for me to listen to her anymore? I can swim. So she was standing on the edge of the pool saying, now, move your arms like this. But he wasn't listening. He didn't need it anymore. He was now able to swim. So he was going here and there, splashing and making a big display. And so one day, because she was very intelligent, when he came, she said, all right, now, today we're not going to put that on. And he was so little he didn't understand. She said, no, into the water with you. And he jumped into the water in the same way. And he started to drown, he started to sink. But unfortunately, because he was not intelligent enough, when he started to sink, he panicked, And then he came splashing, and she easily got him out of the water because it wasn't very deep. She put him back onto the side of the pool, and then he said, "I'll never go to the pool again." And he didn't. So we should learn this is the foolishness of a child, but this can be our foolishness also when we come to the Dhamma, that the buoyant transcendental atmosphere allows us to feel that we can perform sadhana in a way here that we can't do when we go back to the gross materialistic Western atmosphere. So we should be aware of this, and we should take advantage of it fully, but we should be aware of what it's like when you get thrown into the water without your little your little float. And of course, the most essential and the most important level of the Dhamma is to hear the transcendental leelas in the places that they were performed. So if we can go, if we have the good fortune, the clarity of mind and heart, the peacefulness of mind, to go to the places and hear the pastimes in those places that took place, it has a very, very, very potent effect on the heart. Because I've had personal experience again of telling the same pastime in the West and telling the same pastime right there in the place, and it's so different. It's especially different. It's not so different for me, but it's so different for the audience who is hearing. Because the audience who is hearing, they're listening and their mind is doing whatever it's doing and they're trying to grasp something. But you go into the atmosphere and everywhere you look around, there's this atmosphere of that particular pastime. It's so much easier to pray there and to pray to that particular pastime and to have a deep experience of the reality of Krishna's pastimes and thereby of Krishna consciousness. So these three levels, it's as if you dive in and you can go deeper and deeper and deeper according to your ability, and then you can come up again, and as you come up, you're still within that completely transcendental atmosphere, if you take shelter in the proper way of these three aspects. So then, in regards to the culture also, I was thinking how Srila Prabhupada explained that Vedic culture in India is dead now. But it's like a cow, he compared it to a cow, that alive or dead, a cow is valuable. When the cow is alive, it gives you milk, gives you so many wonderful milk products. And when the cow is dead, then you can take its hide and you can use the leather, you can make mridanga and so forth. And if someone is inclined, they can eat meat, they can do so many things with the body of the cow, even when the cow has deceased. So similarly, Srila Prabhupada said, Vedic culture, alive or dead, it is so valuable. So this is essentially what we see in the Dhamma. So then I wanted to explain that there are three different manifestations of the Dhamma. There is the drishyaman. Drishyaman means, basically, drishya means what you can see with the eyes. So it is the manifestation of the Dhamma that we, with our blunt material senses, we can touch, we can see, we can feel, we can look at. It's the in a sense, it is like a very... Srila Jiva Goswami in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Navadvipa Mahatmya asks Nityananda Prabhu, why is it that some people can live in the holy Dham, speaking of Navadvipa, and not make advancement, not become purified? And Srila Nityananda Prabhu explains that there is a very, very fine layer over the Dham, of the modes of material nature. But it's very, very, very fine, you could say. And beneath that is the transcendental. Of course, this beneath and above, these are only for our benefit, because speaking in transcendental has no location. There is no time and space for transcendental reality. But for our understanding, tattva means the theory. So it's placed in a way we can comprehend. So for our understanding, it is as if we are walking on this top part. And if we were qualified, and that qualification comes by Premanjana Charita Bhakti, that if one's eyes become, and one's heart becomes qualified in love, then one can perceive what is beneath that layer. But even walking on that very thin layer, it's like a thin layer of ice over a water pond, as opposed to a mountain of ice. So the West is a dense, dense, dense modes, and underneath there's nothing but more modes. And it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper into the minds and hearts of all the jivas who are there for their purposes. So the Dharma is not like that, yet it has inconceivable oneness and difference, that there is this layer, and you can see that, and you can appreciate the culture on that level. You can practice your sadhana on that level. And if that sadhana becomes very advanced, then you are given opportunity to perceive the next level of manifestation, which is called the aprakat pastime level, which is when Krishna's pastimes, which are continuously, simultaneously going on in every transcendental dharma, and simultaneously they're going in a, like Srila Prabhupada used the word, a road show. They're transferring. As they're performed in one universe, they go to the next universe, to the next universe, to the next universe. Simultaneously, they're eternally going on in that very one universe wherever somebody is residing. So this is the inconceivable nature of Krishna's pastimes. And Kavi Kanpur in the Ananda Vrindavan Champu, at the end, he doesn't explain how, but he says this is definitely the fact, that the pastimes are going on manifest and unmanifest simultaneously. And this is inconceivable to the minds and intellect of the conditioned soul. It's realizable, but it isn't understandable. And then the third level of manifestation of the Dham, of course, is the Prakat Lila, when Krishna is present in the Dham, when he's performing his pastimes with the residents of the Dham. And then when he goes to Mathura, that is also the Aprakat Lila, there's simultaneously Srila, I think it's Srila Raghava Pandit explains in his Krishna Bhakti Ratna Prakash, how those who were eligible of the gopis, for example, they could recognize that Krishna hadn't left, those who were on that platform. But those who were ineligible, they could not understand that Krishna was still present. So I cannot elaborate very much on this, only present the statement. But it seems like a winding of a snake. They would sometimes feel his presence and sometimes feel his absence. And the great personalities of these pastime places, they can enter into this mystery. So there are these three manifestations of the Dharma. And then I was thinking again in threes, that there are three different types, you could say, in a sense. I couldn't find the right word, but there are three different types of transcendental places. There are places that are related to the Vaishnavas who've come here to perform sadhana on that second level, not the cultural level, but the sadhana level. They've come here to perform their sadhana, their bhajan. For example, if you go to Radhakund, you'll see so many baitaks, and in Vrindavan you'll see samadhis. And you also can see here and there, all over Vrindavan, bhajan kutirs, where different exalted personalities have resided for some time, for a long time or for a short time, and have performed their services there. So when we go to those places, we hear of their lives, and gradually by hearing this, we develop an affinity for these personalities, and they start to seem to us to be quite tangible. In the beginning you go and you hear so many things and everything floats around and you feel uncomfortable. And again, if you speak in the West and you speak about these personalities, it takes a far longer time of hearing before a person can develop that same affinity. They can develop very readily if they go to these transcendental holy places. Secondly, we can hear about and see the places related to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's places are very essential for us, because we can only enter into the pastimes of Radha and Krishna in Kali Yuga with all safety, Srila Prabhupada has told us, through the agency of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is not complementary to Radha and Krishna. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is identical with Radha and Krishna. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the servant Krishna, teaching how one can serve and approach Krishna. So if we don't go through the process given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then we have run a great risk of falling into what is actually the greatest danger in the transcendental Dharma, and the one that we all have, that we're always struggling with, and that is the one of trying to enjoy the Dharma. I'd like to read you one little comment. This is from an article which is not at all relevant to us, not at all easy to understand, But it's a particular point from an article in The Harmonist by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's magazine in 1932. But it points this out in a way that really struck me. He says, "It is for the purpose of inspiring a real regard for the transcendental realm of Braj in the minds of the circumambulators that the function has been manifest by the sadhus. It is Krishna. In the realm of Braj, it is not jivas who enjoy the landscape. It is Krishna who is the sole enjoyer of that realm. The jivas have no other function but to minister to the pleasures of Krishna. The landscapes of that realm are instinct with perfect spiritual life. They direct their denizens in their constant service to Krishna." So here he's speaking. He's speaking on the level of vision of a sadhu. A sadhu doesn't see the cultural aspects. A sadhu is not interested in the cultural aspects. They're valuable to us because we're subcultural. We have to get ourselves up to that level, what to speak of higher. But a sadhu doesn't need to come here and circumambulate to remember Krishna. A sadhu comes here and can see how the realm of Braj is entirely, it to every atom is for Krishna's pleasure. And so we come here to follow that mood of a sadhu. We can see in the life of Srila Prabhupada, he lived how his, if you read in that book by Jad Bharat, that circumambulation of Braj Dham, he gives a brief summary of Srila Prabhupada's activities in Vrindavan. And if you read it, there's not a trace of personal enjoyment. He doesn't do things because he likes to, feels like it, wants to. Everything was so focused on two things. One, on service to Krishna here in the Dham, and the other was on distribution of Krishna consciousness throughout the whole world. So this is the function of a sadhu in the Dham. He doesn't need to come here to be reminded of Krishna. But we do, and therefore the process of parikram has been established by the sadhus. And through constant centuries and centuries, great personalities, Vaishnavas, have come here prior to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to circumambulate Braj Mandal and to gain entrance into this mood. So there is first the Vaishnava level of holy places, then there's the pastime places of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When we go there, it's very important that we hear about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mood. And thirdly, there are the pastime places here in Braj of Radha and Krishna. So there too we have to hear very carefully as far as possible. And as I said, always it comes to my mind, if you can't enter on the deepest level, at least get into the water and look around and just look at the culture and see that and imbibe. Start there and then go as deeply as you can from that point. So then, and there were a few other threes that came up, but I don't want to take too long speaking with you. But the last one that I wanted to mention is that there are three, for us, there's three main transcendental dhams that we go to. This is our particular lineage. Through the acharyas in our line, through Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there are three places. We go to Navadvip, we go to Mayapur Navadvip, Jagannath Puri, and we go to Vrindavan Dham. And these are primary. You can go other places also and gain benefit, but these three are in a sense like a triangle. Their significance, they have their intimate, interrelated significance one to the other. So Navadvip Dham is where you can take first darshan of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is the Kali Yuga Pavana, as we were hearing with the 100 names of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he gives the holy names there. That is the benediction of Navadvip Dham. And it is so merciful to go there. There is a lightness because of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because were it to be very firm standards for entrance into Sri Navadvip Dham, how could all the fallen people of the Kali Yuga ever come into the fold of his exalted teachings? So rather, you go there, even if you're sleeping there, you gain the benefits of austerity. If you're eating there, you gain the benefits of austerity. Just to come there, there's so much welcome. Please come here. Please take the Hare Krishna mantra. Please chant it. There's a joyousness that comes from the chanting. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu manifests his pastimes, half pastimes there. Then half his pastimes he came to Jagannath Puri. So in Navadvip Dham, he's manifesting this Sankirtan Leela. But this is, in a sense, again, not that there is such a outer and inner in transcendental realm, but in a sense it is his outer purpose, his purpose for the benefit of others. And his inner purpose, he comes to Jagannath Puri, which is to taste something very specific, that he appears in this world that he wants to taste. Krishna wants to taste the feelings and the position of Srimati Radharani. So in Jagannath Puri, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mood becomes one of intense separation. And though I've always found when I go to Jagannath Puri that externally, culturally, it's a very joyful place to be because of the presence of Lord Jagannath and the Mahaprasad and the sea beach and the weather and so many different ways and saris you can buy and so on and so forth. It becomes quite an enjoyable place. But it's also a very good place to perform sadhana, a very important place to perform sadhana. So cultural, sadhana. But then if you come to the Leela platform, then you find out that the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya there are full of separation mood. Constantly, day and night, he would go into ecstatic moods wherein in his fainting, in his different ecstatic states, he would be envisaging Vrindavan. He would see, sometimes he'd be in a garden and he'd see the Jamuna River rippling and sparkling under the moon, and he would see, this is Vrindavan, this is the Jamuna, the sea, he would see the sea. He would think, this is the Jamuna, and run to the ocean and jump into the ocean. And his followers were constantly trying to take care of him under all sorts of intense separation manifestations that he was performing there. So the pastimes of Puri, they're very confidential. But it is meant that that mood of separation, not imitating Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mood, because he is experiencing the mood of separation of Srimati Radharani, but following the instructions that he gives and following his followers who have written on his behalf. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, Srila Ramananda Roy, Pakishananda Saraswati. He gave his instructions and teachings through these different personalities by following in their footsteps and coming down, of course, to Srila Prabhupada, then one can enter into a sense of understanding what is that mood of separation from Krishna. On our level, what is to be tasted for us? But it is through that, just like in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gop Kumar was feeling increasingly dissatisfied, he would go from place to place to place. And at first he would describe to the Mathura Brahmana the glories of that place. He would go to the bank of the Ganga and it was so nice and everything was so serene. He was very happy chanting his mantra. But then something just wasn't quite to his liking, and then he went to Jagannath Puri. He got to Jagannath Puri, so happy, all the festivals, everything was so nice. And then he became king of Jagannath Puri because they found some mark on his hand that indicated that he was to be the future king. He became the king. He was so happy being the king, managing everything. And then he became so dissatisfied by being the king because he couldn't go to the darshan because his mind was always busy with all the managing of everything. And so he renounced that position. He came back to be with Lord Jagannath, taking darshan more fully with his heart. And then he started feeling, no, something's not right here. And he envied the residents of Jagannath Puri, who were happy there. They were felt completely happy there. And he came from Govardhan. So he was half happy there and half thinking of Govardhan. What am I doing here? So for us, it is like that also. We also belong in Vrindavan. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is giving us Vrindavan. So he's teaching, Sanatana Goswami is teaching like this, how the Gop Kumar, he went higher and higher and higher till he entered into the spiritual world. now transcendental, no longer within the coverings of the universe. And he went to Vaikuntha and he saw, and he was so happy, but then something was constricting his natural flow of love. So then he went from there to Ayodhya, he went here, he went there. He comes to Dwarka, he's come so close, he's now in the realm of Krishna Leela, but there's something, he's even not happy there. And so Narada is speaking to Uddhava and saying, this is most amazing, look, he's in Dwarka, he's in the spiritual world, he's here, and he's unhappy. What is this? How can he be unhappy here? And then Uddhava is saying, he's a cowherd boy, send him, you know, he should go to Vrindavan. And Narada says, no, he should go to Jagannath Puri. It's because from Jagannath Puri, you have so much separation there. This is the way you can enter into Vrindavan. So he explains this. And then Uddhava says, no, don't send him there, just send him straight to Vrindavan. He belongs in Vrindavan, send him to Vrindavan. So he goes straight to Vrindavan from there, and then he enters into the sadhana and the process of actually attaining Krishna's darshan in Vrindavan. So in this way, Sanatana Goswami is explaining to us this relevance of these three transcendental places, and they're non-different. And you have to, they have their distinct characteristics, but they're achintya veda, abheda tattva. They're all related and relevant to us. So when we go to them and hear very carefully there, we begin to see, oh, it's like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Oh, that goes next to that, and that goes there, and this goes here. And it starts to become clear how these transcendental places have been manifest. They're eternally manifest, but they're essential for our spiritual advancement in the age of Kali. So the last thing that I was thinking that's very important, small last thought that I had just when I was about to come in here, was when reading this article from The Harmonist, it's written, you could say, on a much higher level of devotional service than any of us are able to perform. It's written for a different audience. I'll read you something so you can understand what I'm saying. And if you can't exactly understand it, or if you find it a little elevated, I already warned you. This is what he's saying. It is not necessary for the sadhu to perform the extraneous circumambulation of Braj for attaining the sight of Godhead. The mundane tract of the countryside that is trod by every passerby must not be confounded with the highest sphere of the realm of the Absolute. It is not the glorification of any mundane locality, cause, or person for which the devout pilgrim sets out on the prikram of Braj Mandal under the lead of the sadhu. Those who turn their attention to the landscape, this is just what I was telling you should turn your attention to, those who turn their attention to the landscape and the external features of the object of worship, or choose to regard the bath and the journey, the eating and sleeping, as identical with the spiritual function, gain very little by the laborious journey. The whole attention of the pilgrim has to be given not to the landscape, nor to any temple, nor to any deity. The whole attention not to any of these things. Then it is least of all necessary for him to give any attention to the activities of himself. So who amongst us can sort of just dismiss the mind? And there may be some, but certainly most of us will find ourselves very much absorbed in first of all ourselves, and then if lucky we can look around at the surroundings. He says, it is imperative to turn all his attention to the minutest doings and sayings of the sadhu under whose direction he has chosen to perform the devotional journey. If he goes on indulging his own fancies and viewing with his own eyes the entities of the spiritual plane, he may indeed succeed in deluding himself, but he will assuredly miss the only legitimate object of his pilgrimage. So I was reading this last night, and I was looking at it and I was thinking, oh, I don't know how I can present this, but it had come to me while I was preparing. And then it struck me that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is our previous, our Param Guru, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and all the Acharyas prior to that who are in our line, none of them, only Srila Prabhupada, was writing for Westerners. Nobody else was actually writing for Westerners. This was not spoken for Westerners. This was spoken to cultured Indian Vaishnavas within the Vinashram culture who already knew all the things that I'm saying. You'll learn this, you'll learn that. If you go out there, you'll see the cows and you'll think, oh, cows. They knew all of this. They're quite familiar with all this on a very high level already of culture and of even of sadhana. And so he was saying to them on their level, don't look at all these things. You just keep your mind on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is present with you right now, and you will gain everything from that, because his minutest dealings and actions, everything he does, he's doing in full realization of the transcendental Dharma. So observe him. So as I was thinking like this, I realized that this is also relevant to us, because we also have to keep our mind and attention on how we can use our stay here, not only to try to please Krishna, because how can we please Krishna if we don't know him? But primarily we have to consider that we have to keep our mind on pleasing Srila Prabhupada and his mood, and examine his mood when he was living in the transcendental dharms. We can read in the Lilamrita about the austerities of his sadhana, about his lifestyle. We cannot imitate it, but we can keep our attention that we have also the sadhu, and this sadhu has spoken for the benefit of the whole world. He's opened the doors of the transcendental dharma and allowed people to come in who never came before. In 1986, we did the first Brajmandal Prakram, and I was thinking as we were wandering around, we were a very unbecoming lot, and we got harassed a lot because we didn't know anything, and people were seeing white Western ladies walking in this way for the first time. And that's only now, 15, 16 years ago. And it struck me, and it used to kind of like almost thrill me, although I didn't know what to do with it, that this was the first time that this was being done since who knows when. Because there is, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes only once in 1,000 Kali Yugas he comes. He delivers the holy name. This is just, if you put this calculation in terms of the day of Lord Brahma, he comes once a day he comes to see Lord Brahma, appears. So then he comes once, one Kali Yuga. So I was thinking, who knows when was the last time that people under chanting Hare Krishna, following Srila Prabhupada, following Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Westerners were coming and doing this sacred process. So even though it is a fact that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wanted the message to be given to Westerners, and they did write to nourish the Westerners, they were not writing to a large group of Westerners who are coming from all parts of the world. Primarily they were speaking and writing in Bengali to their followers. So we have to take Srila Prabhupada's blessings when we go on Prakram here and accept our position and our circumstance in time and in relationship to the Dharma, and try our best, given our disadvantages, to absorb as much as we can while we're here. And if we're here permanently, it revives and refreshes our appreciation of our being fortunate enough to live here. Then we have to examine how Srila Prabhupada felt when he was living here, what he wanted. And if we don't have that huge weight of responsibility on our shoulders, we have another heavy weight, and that is to take Krishna consciousness, take the impressions, and try to help other people wherever we are by conveying the same to them. So I'd like to stop here. I'd like to read you something very short, but very sweet. This is a small pastime of Govardhan Hill, and it's only very short, but I think you'll enjoy it. This is during the rainy season in Vrindavan. Huh? What place or what book? This is from Ananda Vrindavan Champur. One auspicious day during the rainy season, the cows grazed on the fresh green grass growing in a beautiful valley beside Govardhan. So we've seen cows in Vrindavan now. We saw cows the other day, we've seen Govardhan, so we've got some frame of reference to enter the pastime. The jewels and precious stones on the surface of Govardhan radiated a beautiful glow. Krishna sat on a throne made of smooth stones. Did anyone see this throne on Govardhan made of a smooth stone? It was a big square dais up there. So he sat on a throne next to a waterfall flowing with fragrant water from the top of the hill. Enjoying the atmosphere, he laughed and joked with his friends. Krishna's boyfriends played a game using some crystalline stones having a dark blue mirror-like surface. So the thing that is very appreciative when we hear from the various exalted personalities who can enter to these pastimes, who have that premanjana, who can see these pastimes, they can elaborate on tiny little details because these personalities who are writing in this way, they're embellishing on the Srimad Bhagavatam. From their own, they're taking the Bhagavatam, then they can see, and they're giving little details to add and to enhance on the Bhagavatam. So, while they pushed and shoved each other, this is the boys' play, a lightning bolt suddenly flashed out of the clouds. It seemed that the clouds cast an angry look just to stop the boys' play. Becoming frightened, the boys ran away. Then they returned, having regained their courage. But when the clouds thundered again, the boys ran away again. Then, picking up some creepers, they pretended to beat the clouds in retaliation. The clouds, however, responded by drenching them with a quick spray of rainwater. At this time, the joyful cowherd boys painted Krishna's body with colorful mineral powders found on Govardhan Hill. As his friends surrounded him and happily danced for his pleasure, Krishna floated in a river of bliss. Then he wandered around Govardhan Hill performing various ecstatic pastimes. As Krishna's heart is full of rasa and decorated with the mark of Lakshmi, similarly Govardhan Hill is full of beauty and a wealth of fresh fruits and edible roots during the rainy season. Krishna relished the sweet natural taste of the various fruits and roots brought by his intimate friends, whose hearts surged with happiness. Bound by their pure love, Krishna easily finished all the foodstuffs collected from Govardhan. With his white teeth shining attractively as he smiled in satisfaction, Krishna easily stole the hearts of every living entity. Krishna's friends quickly prepared his favorite flavored pan from betel nuts, pure white lime paste, fragrant juice of bananas that smelt of camphor, and other items that they had previously collected from Govardhan. Thus being served in various ways, Krishna enjoyed his pastimes on Govardhan Hill. Krishna took shelter of the caves of Govardhan Hill whenever the clouds sprinkled water. Sitting there, biding his time until the rain stopped, Krishna appeared like a beautiful baby elephant. The boys entertained that enchanting person by playing a game of shouting loudly into the back of the cave and laughing at the echo. Vibrating deep, angry sounds, they said, "Who are you? What are you saying?" The cave filled with clamor. Ordinarily, it is offensive to mistreat a giver of shelter. Yet this irreverent behavior in the cave did not fault the cowherd boys, but embellished them with the ability to please Krishna. Indeed, they blessed that cave with their presence. Meanwhile, outside the cave, it appeared that the rain smiled with its teeth of hailstones falling everywhere. Krishna's friends happily ran outside to pick up the particles of ice and bring them back into the cave. With their hands folded as in Pushpanjali, they offered Krishna hailstones as flowers to Krishna's lotus feet. So this is a very sweet pastime, from just to give us a feeling of the pastimes around Govardhan. Govardhan nourishes all the devotees. So the pastimes of cowherding are so sweet. The pastimes of Rasa Leela are so sweet. The gopis would come here to meet Krishna daily, to all the places culminating in Radhakund and Shamakund, which are the most transcendental places for the Madhurya devotees. And the pastimes in Nanda Maharaj, and they would, the Aniyor festival of Govardhan. Everyone was always satisfied and happy to be at Govardhan. So I'll stop now. And we're going to take prasad, is that right? Vajrihari? And then we're going to proceed to, first of all, to a place called Peta, which is not a place that is usually visited very often because it's a bit of a bus ride away from the hill itself. It's on the road back towards Mathura, about 3 or 4 kilometers. So we'll go there. It's a place that's also that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu visited. And then we're going from there, we'll drive back to Govindkund, but we will stop only short, we'll just take darshan there, then we'll walk the Parikram path from Govindkund to Surabikund. And possibly on the way between there we'll stop and hear a little of the Govardhan Leela. And then at Surabikund we'll hear the rest of the Govardhan Leela. And Surabikund is also a very remote place. Most people don't go there. But it's a very, very important place. So we'll go there. And then after that, then we will go to Punchari, and Maharaj will enliven and enlighten us all about Krishna's wonderful Rasalila pastimes with the Braj Gopis. Okay. So, thank you very much. And if anyone wants to look at my book, they can. The deity here is a very old Narayan deity. This is the kund outside is called Narayan Sarovara. And this temple is the Chaturbhuj Narayan Mandir. This place is called Peta, and it's about 5 kilometers from Govardhan Township. And this is one of the very oldest deities, actually, in Vrindavan. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, came here, visited this place when he was taking his tour of Brajmandal when he came to Vrindavan. So the question may be asked, why is this deity so special? Why are we coming here to see Lord Narayan in Braj? There's a pastime. I'll read from the Adilila, chapter 17. During the season of springtime, when the Rasa dance was going on, suddenly Krishna disappeared from the scene, indicating that he wanted to be alone with Srimati Radharani. So within 2 kilometers on the road we were coming on one side there is one place called Chandra Sarovara. And Chandra Sarovara is also mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It is the place where during the spring Rasalila festival, the moon, Chandra, became so bewildered and amazed to see the beauty of the dancing of Krishna and the gopis. So this whole area on the other side, earlier on this road, is a place called Parasoli, which is where the spring Rasalila festival takes place. This whole area here, and then where we will end our parikram at Punchari, they're especially saturated with the pastimes of Radha and Krishna and their spring Rasalila festivals.
Parasoli is Chandrasarov?
No, it's a village on the other side, just before. All in this area. As far as I know, in Vrindavan, at Rasastali in Vrindavan, Krishna there, when he played his flute at Vamsivat and the gopis came, there was all kinds of gopis there. There are different categories of gopis in Braj. Some of them are jivas who are coming up, they have been elevated to the position of participating in Krishna's pastimes. Some of them are great sages called the Municharis, who were present in the time of Lord Ramachandra, who saw Lord Ramachandra, and he gave them the benediction that they would take birth in Braj during his pastimes here, Krishna, in his Krishna Leela. Some of them are the Shrutis, the Vedic mantras become personified as gopis. So we can see how elevated these personalities of Braj are. And some of them are the Deva Kanya, the wives, the daughters of the demigods, who were also asked to take their birth here to perform some part of Krishna's Boma Leela pastimes. So at the Vamsivad, all these gopis come, all different classes of gopis, and Srimati Radharani becomes a little slighted to see that Krishna is here, he's called, and oh, everyone has come. So she makes the superiority of her position obvious by disappearing from the Rasalila arena. Here in Peta, in this Rasalila, the gopis who came were not all classes of gopis. But in this area, as far as I can remember, it is not only the group of gopis who are all the confidential friends of Srimati Radharani. I was reflecting on how everything in Braj, everything in the spiritual world, is somewhat in a shadow form, in some form in the material world. So although we cannot take the shadow and then speculate on the reality, we can gain some insights into the reality from observation of the shadow. So there are four kinds of gopi groups in Vrindavan. Four, and this is true even, you can see this in everywhere, four kinds of people according to relationship anywhere, in this world, everywhere. There is what is known as swapaksha. Swapaksha means they're your group, intimate. They're like your best friends. So there's Swapaksha, my group. Then the next class is called Srit. Srit, we heard this word yesterday, that Krishna is the Sridam Sarva Bhutanam, the friend of all. So there are gopi girls, girls in the village, who are friendly. They're not intimate, but they're friendly. And we see this in our own experience of life also. Some people are very close friends. Some people, they're our friends. And the next category, they're called tatasta. That means they're neutral. They're not exactly friends, but they're definitely not inimical. They're kind of like people who, you know, they're nice, but you don't have a very friendly, warm relationship with them. And then the fourth group that exists everywhere is vipaksha, or those who you don't like, who are in your opposite party. So it's like this also with the gopis. There are those who are swapaksha. They are in a group with Srimati Radharani. Then there are those who are srit. They're friendly. They come and they'll take part in the pastimes and they mix very freely. But they have their own independent circle also. And then the neutral ones, they won't interfere. They won't maybe come. They may come, they may not come. They're neutral. But the vipaksha means they're always planning and scheming how they can get Krishna to be with their sakis or their friends. So in this way, there are these different levels of relationships or groups, you could say, amongst the residents of Vrindavan also. But of course, unlike the material world where this is all based on hard feelings and unpleasantries, everything is based on Krishna's pleasure, and therefore there is a very thick underlying loving relationship of everyone with Krishna. So here, Krishna called dancing with the gopis, and these four categories were there. Not the wives, the daughters of the demigods, and the Municharis, the Munis in as gopis, not the Shruticharis, but these Swapaksha, friends, neutral, and some Vipaksha. And Vipaksha means that is a Chandravali's group of gopis. So Srimati Radharani has her friends, Chandravali has her friends. So they were dancing here, Krishna was dancing with them. But he wanted to single out Srimati Radharani. So he himself disappeared here. He left them. And they were all together and he disappeared. So they all started looking for him. And he went and he sat down in a lonely place. You can see this is a very lonely place. a very peaceful place here. He sat somewhere in a bush in a lonely place. He wanted to be alone with Srimati Radharani. Krishna was sitting in a solitary bush waiting for Radharani to pass by. But while he was sitting, the gopis arrived there like a phalanx of soldiers. So they all came looking for him. Where is he? He's disappeared. And they were all united now. Where is he? We'll find him. So this was not his plan. He wanted to single out one special gopi. So he was sitting there, the gopis arrived and they said, look, there's Krishna, he's sitting in that bush. Then, as soon as Krishna saw all the gopis, he was struck with emotion. Thus he could not hide himself. And so out of fear, he remained completely motionless. He didn't do anything. And they're all coming towards him very quickly. So what could he do? So he had a plan. Krishna assumed a four-armed form of Narayan. He added another pair of arms. And he was just sitting here waiting. So they all came. And this is the point that the Chaitanya Charitamrita is making, is that the sentiments, the specific loving sentiments of the residents of Vrindavan, particularly the gopis, cannot be experienced or offered to any other form other than Krishna. So when the gopis searching for Krishna came here and they saw this four-armed form, what did they do? When they came and they saw him, they spoke as follows. They said, oh, he's not Krishna. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's Narayan. So then what do? They come up to him and with very great respect, just as we did, they came up to him, Narayan, and they paid their obeisances and they folded their hands and they offered prayers of respect to him like you would offer to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they said so many things, offered their obeisances, and then they said, oh Lord Narayan, we offer our respectful obeisances unto you. Kindly be merciful to us. And what did they want? They said, please give us the association of Krishna and vanquish all our lamentations. They offered, then they said again, they offered their obeisances. They come to see the deity, we offer our obeisances, and then we go. So they saw it's a deity. They weren't interested in Narayan. They had no interest. It was Krishna. But as soon as he assumed the form of Narayan, the gopis had no particular interest except to ask him for the benediction that they could meet with Krishna. So they all dispersed. And then Srimati Radharani came. And she appeared before Krishna. When Sri Krishna saw Radharani, he wanted to maintain this four-armed form to joke with her. He wanted to play a trick on her so she also would be surprised. He would trick her. But in front of Srimati Radharani, although Sri Krishna tried his best to keep his four arms, he was completely unable to do so. The influence of Srimati Radharani's pure ecstasy is so inconceivably great that it forced Krishna to come to his original two-handed form. So the speciality of this place, Peta, is at this place, the superior position of Srimati Radharani is established by this deity of Chaturbhuj Narayan, Krishna, pretending, disguising himself, tricking the other gopis, but totally unable, with his best of efforts, to stand in this form before the loving affection of Srimati Radharani. So when we were looking at the deities, one of the devotees mentioned to me that this place, the deity here, reminded them of Alalanath. And this is actually a fact. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would go to Alalanath, he would see there, because he would leave Jagannath Puri. He left Jagannath Puri. Why? Because Lord Jagannath disappeared. Lord Jagannath would go into his inner chambers, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu without Lord Jagannath, whom he saw only as Shyamasunda. He didn't see Lord Jagannath in Aishwarya sentiment. So when Lord Jagannath was no longer visible, he couldn't tolerate the separation. So in the mood of Srimati Radharani, he would come here, he would go to Alalanath. And when he would see the deity of Alalan, in Alalanath, then he too would enter the same ecstatic state as Srimati Radharani, and he would see there also that that deity was not a four-handed Narayan form, but it was Shyamasundara himself. And if anyone is fortunate enough to go to Lalnath, you can see there that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he would roll on the ground or offer his obeisances, the intensity of his ecstatic love would melt the stone. And you can see the impression of the, as he's paying his obeisances, the different parts of his body impressed into the stone there. To this day, that stone is visible. So these two places, they are actually, they do have a special connection. I could talk more, but I think that it's important that we keep moving because we're running quite a few hours late.
No, it's only 10 to 8.
I saw that, but I thought that was PM.
Then we're early, because it's yesterday.
But so what is the general consensus? Should we keep moving, Maharaj? Or would you like to speak also something now?
Amine. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Vacharine Nirvashesha Shunyavari Paskatyare Satarine Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Karada Sri Vasadi Govardhana Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Actually this place Paita teaches us as devotees of Krishna a very important and deep lesson. To reach Sri Krishna you need to be ekaha manasa. Your mind must be totally fixed on him and him only. In his Manakshiksha, Srila Raghunathas Goswami describes that ekaha bhakta should not even worship Lord Narayan, Lakshmi Narayan in the Vaikuntha planets. An example of an ekaha bhakta is Gop Kumar, who feels nowhere in the different spiritual manifestations happy until he finally reaches Goloka Vrindavan. I think it is so wonderful that this particular temple is kept up for devotees to see so that they can pray here for that single-minded concentration on Sri Krishna in no other form of the Lord. This is very important for us in our Gaudiya Vaishnava line, this place. Imagine the gopis just, they're looking for Krishna. They had no idea that Krishna is God, but they were in love. And by this love, they were able to purchase Krishna and make an in-depth. Just imagine, they were going through the forest looking for Krishna, saw Narayan and said, Narayan, where is Krishna? This is so wonderful. This is so... Everything else disappears before Krishna. This is actually what a devotee in Krishna consciousness ultimately must attain in his life. This total absorption in Sri Krishna out of a deep feeling of attachment. This is here is where we can get our highest good, our treasure in life. Here we see the example of the gopis in whose footsteps we should step in order to reach Krishna. One thing which I know is that the time when there was a lot of religious unrest and the Muslims were engaging here in their religious intolerance, that deity became hidden by the pujaris in that lake which you see, this beautiful big lake, and it was found later. There are few Vrindavan deities who are known for hiding themselves. Dauji is another one who was in that Chia lake, and there are many others like this. This particular concept of fixing only on Krishna, it is the wealth of Vrindavan, and fixing on Krishna with this utter concept of Krishna, you are wonderful, and everything else disappears. This is here to be gotten. If you kindly allow me, there is one lady in Mathura who had heard that Krishna is performing his pastimes in Vrindavan. She was a simple fruit dealer and came with a basket of fruits before Nanda Maharaja's palace. Her idea was, I wish to sell my fruits this day, not in Vrindavan and in Mathura, but I will go to Vrindavan and sell them there. And as she was sitting before Nanda Maharaja's palace, Krishna was inside having loving exchanges with his mother Yashoda and the other gopis. All of a sudden, little Krishna heard from outside the sound of someone calling. She wanted this. She heard the voice of that simple fruit dealer. She wanted to say, "Falau, take fruit." But because she was thinking all the time of Gopal, what came out of her, what was in her heart, became out, like Burijan Prabhu told us, the secret of preaching, what's in the heart of a preacher comes out. She said, Gopal Lau, Krishna Lau, Govinda Lau. And there is a rule, whenever a devotee sincerely cries for Krishna, Krishna must come. So Krishna just went through the palace, took a few grains, and he came on the brink of the palace door, stood there with his two hands like this, beautiful locks surrounding his hair, his moon-like face, the earrings dancing and making a nice light on her cheeks, on his cheeks. And this is how the fortunate fruit dealer saw Krishna, and she totally absorbed herself in Krishna's beautiful form. Krishna came, quickly gave her some of the grains which were left. He had seen that his father dealt with grains for barter and got articles, so he had picked that. But because he was so small, all the grains fell out of his hand, and he could only give a few grains to the fruit vendor. But the fruit vendor was so happy that she gave him all her fruits. Krishna quickly returned into the palace. The fruit vendor from this moment was destroyed. Her patience was gone. She only saw that beautiful little boy, Krishna, who had fascinated her heart. And on her way, as she crossed the Yamuna, on her way to Mathura, she left her body in the Yamuna and went back to Goloka Vrindavan. Hare Krishna. So Krishna took the fruits and distributed them to all the devotees, the friends of Mother Yashoda. Satyavrata Muni has also prayed in his Damodarashtakam about this fascination of Krishna. He said, "My dear Lord, I don't want anything else. No darshan of Narayan, nothing. I only want your beautiful face to appear in my heart again and again. And I meditate upon that robe which your loving devotee has bound around your belly, because this is a glorious robe which has bound you, the robe of love." This concept, Braj concept of Krishna, is very special. It is nowhere held in no religious system whatsoever, that the most powerful aspect of the Lord, Narayan, from whom all this, the spiritual and the material world comes, is neglected for the God of love, the God of absorption, the God of fascination, the Krishna. And this treasure is the good begotten here in Paita. And we must thank our Jagatarini Mataji that she has, in her tremendous kindness, thought us fit to enter this beautiful place. Thank you very much, Mataji. It was here is the treasure. You have found the treasure place of Braj. It's really at the treasure place of Braj, because of this Krishna concept overruling the Narayan or any other concept. This is what Braj Bhakti is all about. It is wonderful. I'm sorry, I have nothing. Maybe talk a little topsy turvy, but it is so wonderful. Hare Krishna.
We heard the basic pastime of this place, how the forearms of that Krishna had assumed, the two extra arms, they could not hold in front of the love of Srimati Radharani. How much love was that? And of course, we are aspiring to be devotees, so we can think how much love we have. And how much love did Srimati Radharani have that actually forced the disappearance of two of Krishna's arms? He could not maintain his disguise before her love of him. So to give us an idea about that, as Lagtuini Mataji explained, that this place is no different from Alarnath, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would go during the time after the Snana Yatra of Lord Jagannath. When Lord Jagannath gets bathed, there are 2 weeks where his body is repainted. And during those 2 weeks, none of the devotees can go and see him. And during that time, Lord Jagannath, or Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, couldn't bear to be in Jagannath Puri with all the same places that he would see every day as he would see Lord Jagannath. He couldn't bear to see those same places and not see Lord Jagannath. So he would have to leave. The pain was so great, he would leave and he would go to this place, Alarnath. And there's an expression in logic called Chandra Shaka Nyaya. Anyone know what Chandra Shaka Nyaya means? The moon, yes. Chandra is the moon, Shaka is the branch. So if the moon is over there somewhere and you ask me, where is the moon? So I say, well, just look at that branch of the tree over there, just above the branch, then you'll see the moon. Now, of course, the moon is far away, actually, far away from that branch. It's situated thousands of miles away. But by looking at the branch, we get an idea of what the moon is, the direction the moon is. So think of what happened to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his separation when he would see the forearm deity of Alwarnath. Think of someone that you have affection for. Some of us may feel very lonely like when we do that because we think that maybe we don't have affection for many people in this world. But think of someone who you have affection for. And maybe when you think of that person, maybe the heart will beat a little more strongly, or even the body will get a little, the blood will move a little faster and the body will get warm like that. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would bow before this Alwarnath, the heat of his body in separation melted stone. Melted stone. So therefore, he was defining what love actually is. So when someone would say to Mahaprabhu that you have prem, you love, he'd say, no, no, no. If I actually had love for Krishna, I could not even remain in my body. When Uddhava came to Vrindavan and he saw Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj, he was astounded at their love for him, for Krishna, because Krishna wasn't there. And Mother Yasoda was crying. Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? He's not here. And Nanda Maharaj, his mood was different. He said, why, you old lady, why are you crying? Krishna is here. Can't you see him? His separation had caused a different type of ecstasy. And Uddhava was so struck with wonder because he was used to seeing the quality of the love of the residents of Dwarka for Krishna, which is so wonderful. But seeing the love of the residents of Vrindavan for Krishna, the beloved Yasoda Devi and Nanda Maharaj, he was so struck. And he said to Nanda Baba, you love Krishna so much. And he said, no, I'm still alive. When Ram left for the forest, Dasarath died. And I am still alive. I have no love for Krishna. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also said, I have no love for Krishna. So we just with the Chandrashaka Nyaya try to understand how much love we have for Krishna, we will become probably quite humble in our estimation of ourselves. But this place really shows and it points to the love, what is actually love for Krishna. And as Maharaj said, it is ekanishta. So completely focused. What was the term used?
Ekantavakti.
One thing only. One thing only. Krishna, 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 Krishna. Hare Krishna. So we should pray.
We must pray. It's very important. This is one of the very, very special places of Braj.